In 2018, a first-of-its-kind study through Cornell University shows that about 113 million American adults have an immediate family member who is formally or currently incarcerated. One in four American adults has a sibling who is incarcerated. This is Melissa Goodman with Reentry Reframed, a Mirror Inc.-sponsored podcast. I have with me today a very, very special guest, LaShonda Daniels. How is it going?
Wonderful. How are you, Melissa?
Well, you and I both have had a rough couple of days, stressful couple of days, and so I thought that this is really cool that we have this planned out to meet today when there's a somewhat happy ending.
Yes, ma'am.
And it's Friday.
Yes.
It is Friday. So some things I don't know. Tell me about you. How and where did you grow up?
So I was born in Paris, Texas, but I've been raised in Topeka all my life. I was in the health industry, and then I moved over to the drug and alcohol treatment facility. I've been with Mirror for almost 9 years now.
Going back even more, tell me about growing up. What did that look like?
Texas is, it was fun. I go back every year pretty much. I pretty much was just born there. I've been raised here. I have two brothers, a sister. I was raised with my mom and dad in the house past 18. It was good.
So pretty normal childhood.
Normal.
Okay. And in Texas, you were born in Texas, but do you have extended family in Topeka?
Yes.
Okay. So that's what brought you back to Topeka.
Yes.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be in the health field, and I did that, but it wasn't what I really wanted to do once I was in it. Mm-hmm. I did want to do other things that did involve health care. My mom was employed with Mirror, and she said that that was something that she thought that I would enjoy. And so she said I should come over. And at first I was like, no, I don't want to do that. And then a couple years later, I came and applied, and I love it. And I see Mirror as my future. Retiring, that is where I'm at now. I enjoy what I do. I enjoy the people that I work with, being treatment or the RRC side.
We're going to get into all that stuff, because one of the reasons why I wanted to have you in here is because in many ways you are the heart and the first face that many people see. I think what holds a lot of people to Mirror and in treatment is your warmth whenever they come in. That's critical and vital to their success.
I love being the face of Mirror, if that is how you want to say it.
I
love being the first people that they do meet when they come into Mirror. I let them know your family. Once you walk in this door, your family, when you do leave here, how we treat you while you're here, you are family. Mm-hmm. When they leave, they are still family. Clients call. We have clients who call who have been gone 6, 7, 8 years, and they still call to keep in contact. And I believe that is because of how they were treated while they were in the facility.
Going back, talking a little bit about your mom, I remember working with your mom, with Linda. That was because she was there. How many years did she work for Mirror?
I believe it was 7.
Yeah, because I think she opened before we had the BOP contract, probably when we had the DOC contract. Are you okay with us talking about Dietrich? Okay, so tell me about Dietrich, and then I'll share a little bit about working with him.
My nephew, he was killed a few years ago, but he also worked at Mirror on the RRC side. I'm not for sure how long he got killed. He was shot a few years back. That affected our family a lot. My sister, she worked at Mirror as well in the kitchen. It hit pretty hard.
Was that Dietrich's mother?
Yes, ma'am. So that it was rough. Miss Jada, the cook in the kitchen, it actually happened in her front yard. She helped him, but he did not survive.
How old was he?
Dietrich was in his early 30s when he passed.
Okay, he was one of those people. He looked like very, very young, and he's such a big guy, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And being that my brother was in treatment in Shawnee Mirror, we had went to visit him, and then me, my mom, and my sister, and I dropped them off, and as I was on my way home, they called me and told me that my nephew had got shot. So we went to the hospital. And in my mind, being that he was such a big guy, he was going to make it. Mm-hmm. And he didn't. But you never know. So I've had a lot of deaths. I have a very big family. So I've had a lot of deaths in my family, incarceration,
How did that loss affect your family, your sister, everyone?
It was hard. It's still hard. Mm-hmm. It still affects my sister, and she has four other kids, but that it hurt her bad. And to this day, it still affects her. It affects a lot of us. Wrong place, wrong time. A lot of people say that about individuals, but unless you know them, you don't know, you know, but wrong place, wrong time.
Yeah, he was, I have this memory of him, and I don't know why it's this, but he was working over in Building 4, and I was getting us something to eat, and at the Mexican place out south, you know, the kind of the fast food, Ponchos, that's what it is, Ponchos. And I just remember we had so much food, and then we both still had to work like a long time. He was really fun to work with. He was funny.
He's wonderful. Great cook. Wonderful dad.
He had a son. Is that right?
Uh-huh. He has three kids. Four kids. He was a wonderful dad.
How old are his children now?
I'm not for sure. I want to say they're maybe 4, 5, 6.
That's hard with a big family, too.
It is hard. It's very hard on my sister. It's like she lost a piece of herself when he passed, and she hasn't gotten that back yet. And you can't tell anybody, you know, it's going to be okay. Or I think she's trying to get back to her, and she will. It's just getting there. She has good support within our brother and sister and mom and dad. We're pretty close, and we're there for each other.
Was your mother, was she still working at Mirror when Dietrich passed away?
Yes, ma'am.
I think I do remember. Oh, again, my condolences to your entire family. Thank you. He was a lot of fun, and people really liked him. Yes, the ma'am. Residents yeah. really liked him. He was funny, and he was kind to people. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I read a fact at the beginning is it's statistical information about related to some of what we'll talk about today. Most of that's about you, but focusing on having siblings incarcerated, can you tell me about the first time? How old were you when one of your brothers went to prison? Which one was it?
It may have been I'm sure it was my younger brother, and we're very close. There's four of us. We're 2 years apart. Me and my younger brother are like twins, just born on different days. But it's hard because you don't have them here, and you don't know what's going on in there. And then we still have lives outside, you know, so trying to still live our life, but wanting to be there for them, it's hard. Making sure that they get visits, you know, and wanting to visit or not being able to, you know, and then so it's disappointing for them. It's disappointing for us, but just trying to make it all work. And he's the baby, you know, so it's hard. And he was young, so.
That's what I was going to ask. How old were you?
I was probably 19, maybe.
He's young, so he would have been probably
just 18.
An adult. How long was he incarcerated for?
I can't remember.
Did it feel like a really long time?
It always does. It always does.
That was one of my next questions as far as how much time then after that. What did your older brother go into the system?
My older brother is just recently, maybe within the last 4, 5 years, maybe. Okay. And that was hard because it's like we're all different in our own ways. So not saying for my younger brother, it's okay for him. And then for my older brother, it's like, no, you don't need to be in prison. Prison's not for you. You know what I mean? But it was harder probably for my older brother, maybe because he was older.
You think harder on you and your family?
Yeah. My older brother is hard. It's hard for both of them. It's just my older brother. It's just different. Me and my younger brother, we lived a different life. Mm-hmm. We ran the streets. We were in the streets. And so that's the life that we lived. And so we not expected for the outcome to be what the outcome was, but not saying that we were okay with it, but the life we lived, our consequences was our consequences. With my older brother, it was different because his head was on different than me and my younger brother. And so growing up, we looked up to my older brother, and my older brother, he was there for us growing up, you know, not saying like he was a dad figure, but if we needed him, he was there. And that's how we all are with each other. But it was just harder to see my older brother go to prison And he was there for 14 months. He was in and out of jail, but it was like when he got to his 40s is when he started going in and out of jail. Mm-hmm. You know, me and my younger brother, we were there before. We had did all that when we were younger. So it was like, I don't know how my mom and dad slept when me and my younger brother were younger. Mm-hmm. Now that I have an older son, it was like, I don't know how my mom and dad slept in those days, because it was two of us doing
running around.
My older brother and sister had their head on straight. So for my older brother to go to prison in his 40s, it hit different, because that's not your life. Mm-hmm. You know, that's our life. So we thought, so could be said, mm-hmm. but that shouldn't be your life.
What do you think it was that, to be somewhat later in life or middle age, what do you think it was about that? Why do you think there was, what was the catalyst of?
My older brother had got addicted to drugs.
Okay.
And that was his downfall.
With you and your younger brother, was your younger brother, how long of a period of time were you looking at where he was in and out of the justice system?
A while. I'm not going to say we got used to him in and out, because we never wanted him in.
Sure.
We always wanted him out. We were always in and out. We could go to jail, mom and dad's going to bond us out. So we didn't really have consequences, maybe, because if we go to jail, we know mom or dad's going to be there to bond us out. It was hardly ever times when we may get booked in to go upstairs. So just depending on what we did to get upstairs and get booked in was however long we were going to be there or whatnot.
Oh, so you guys were getting in trouble together?
Sometimes.
I love Shonda. No, I'm kidding.
He's my twin. My older brother got addicted to drugs. So just with the drug addiction and everything that comes with that is what led him to prison.
Okay. Okay, that makes sense. Kind of piecing it out, thinking about it in my mind. With you, what do you think it was your turning point as far as changing course and turning your life around to serve others?
With me, honestly, the guy in my life, I've been with him for 16 years, and he is actually what had me turn my life around. I feel like he's seen something in me that I didn't, and I believe that's why I'm here today. Mm. I didn't care. I didn't care to go to jail. I didn't care.
What do you think it was? Why do you think you felt like that?
I don't know.
You felt lost?
I didn't feel lost. Maybe I felt like I could just do what I wanted to do. I didn't have my son till I was 25, so I didn't really have any responsibilities. I've been working since I was 14, mm-hmm. so I had my own money. You know, I could do what I wanted. I didn't have any responsibilities, so I didn't really have a care. You know, I could say I really wanted to be anything I wanted to be, but I didn't have any maybe motivation to do it. I got my GED when I was 36. I was pregnant with my third child, you know. So I really give credit to my guy, because I feel like if it wasn't for him, I would probably be dead or in prison.
What's his name?
Lance.
Shout out to Lance. Thank you, because you have touched so many lives. So how did you guys meet?
Through my family.
Okay. And yeah. So you said he saw something in you that you didn't see.
I was rough, and he stayed. I had been in abusive relationships. I was an alcoholic. I was rough. I would have left myself, and he stayed. He seen something in me, and I would have left myself.
And sometimes people will say attaching themselves to something positive, whether it be a person or education, a program, anything that can be really helpful. So what changes did you start to make to better your life?
I think it was when I did get with him, the stability. I worked odd jobs, restaurants, but when I got with him, it was more of the stability. That's when I got in the health field. So I'm just going to say the stability. I sent my son off with his dad. I didn't want him going house to house like I was. And it was just with my family. I wasn't like couch surfing. Mm-hmm. I went to school for my CNA, my Med Aid, and then my son was with his dad for a year, and then he came back with me. But then, like, even running the streets, I didn't want my son seeing all that. But I really didn't straighten up probably until 2007. And then I've been good ever since.
How many children do you have?
Three.
Okay, so at that time, your oldest son, he's the one you're referring to.
Uh-huh. And even when I had him, it didn't slow me down, mm-hmm. because I had my mom and dad pretty much there. I stayed with them, and so they helped me with him so I could still run the street, but I settled down.
So being a really close-knit family, how do you think you go from being supportive to enabling? I mean, what do you think the difference between being supportive and enabling is?
I don't think I can answer that because I think I'm an enabler. Okay. Because I'll tell my brother, the next time you go to prison, don't call me. Mm-hmm. I'm not doing care packages. I'm not doing anything. But I'm the first one he calls, and I'm going to send that care package. I'm going to send whatever he needs. You know, I think I just throw the threat out there, hoping he won't go to jail, you know, but I'm going to send him whatever he needs, you know, but I'm an enabler as far as that part. But I love my family, and I'm going to do whatever I can to help enable, probably. So I don't really know what that
looks like. Okay. I mean, I appreciate that honesty and not placing any blame whatsoever on your parents. I mean, it's so hard, and I can't imagine what they went through and what parents go through. But, you know, you think about going to jail. You talked about going to jail over and over again and knowing you'd be bailed out. I just wonder if you would have spent some time, like, do you think that would have been more of a deterrent?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I did spend maybe a couple of months, but that was enough for me. Mm-hmm. I don't want people telling me what to do every day. I don't want to live that life. It wasn't for me.
When your brother, and you mentioned your older brother, how it changed your family dynamic when he went to prison. When your younger brother went to prison, do you think it changed your family dynamic?
Absolutely. He's the baby, and nobody wanted him there. He got visits a lot, probably more than my older brother. But just knowing that your baby brother is in prison with God only knows who, for what, and for why, and to know that he's not there for nothing major, is like, you're helpless because you can't go in there and help him. You can't. You don't really know what he needs other than what he's telling you. You know what I mean? He could be hurting, but you can't get to him to help him, you know? So that's just me. I love my family. I love my brothers. I love my sister. I'll do anything for them. And so for them to be behind the bars and all I can do is send a care package, if that's all I can do, that's what I'm going to do. Visits, I'll be there. I was there. I probably didn't visit them as much as I probably could have, but I did.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like a lot of fear. You carried him with you, and you carried a lot of fear for his safety.
Safety. Both of them.
That's a lot.
Because I look at my older brother like, that's not the place for you. Maybe looking at it like he couldn't protect himself. While looking at my younger brother, he can protect. I know he can protect himself, but I'm still his protector in my mind, you know. But it's just the difference in my brothers is it's not a place for either one of them, but well, just different.
And one thing I know through this past year and some of what you've been through and your family's been through is that your brothers are very protective of you too.
Yeah.
That goes both ways with you all. So you all just sound like extremely close knit. So when you were feeling helpless and scared, how can someone ease some of that fear, in your opinion?
Accepting the phone calls, because you don't know if you're going to get a phone call tomorrow. You don't know what's going to happen. You hear about people dying in prison now with no reason why. So just picking up the phone call, just being there, you know. It's not always about money or the care packages, you know. I think it's that phone call, really. When I was locked up, I ran my brother's phone bill off the wall, you know. So I get it. But I think it's that phone call more than anything, or the visits.
And that phone call connecting you to someone outside those walls. And that's good feedback, too, because in the federal system, most people are not incarcerated in Kansas. And so you're going somewhere across the country.
Away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so many people in the federal system, that's one thing that always, I guess, surprised me, is the distance that people would be incarcerated. And many wouldn't have a visit their entire sentence.
Mm-hmm. So with that, it was like, it would be like you would want to pick up the phone, be available that way, you know, because some people probably wouldn't get a visit the whole time they've been locked up.
Yeah, that's very good feedback. I was thinking about our conversation about violence in our community, and I used to do groups like transition skills groups back when I was at the RRC more, and I had just had my first son, and I was doing these groups, and somewhat it was focused on, you know, violence. And I'd sit there in a room full of guys and women, but I would mostly men. And I would try to explain to them the amount of love that is poured into your baby and to your child and how precious every single life is, that someone loves this person so much, whether it be their mom, their dad, their grandma, their cousin, their aunt. You know, someone loves this person so much. And whatever, in the grand scheme of things, petty argument or issue that you guys have together, someone has poured so many hours and days and years and everything into this child, into this person, human being. Every life is so valuable. So I'm sitting there like a new mom trying to explain to these guys, like, please just consider that the next time you're in a situation, consider how precious every single life is. And think about that with Dietrich and some of what you've been through too. Mm-hmm. They probably just thought I was crazy. Oh, it's just molested. Yeah. Being hormonal. but I do think about that in our community. You said you always knew you wanted to work in healthcare. Why?
I like helping people. I love helping people.
Where do you think you get that from?
It might be something that's just within my family because we are so tight-knit. Maybe not as tight as we used to be, but that's how I grew up. Sunday dinners. I say my mom and dad's house was the mission because anybody in my family could stay. So I think that's why. It's just I've always seen my mom or my aunts or uncles or dads there for people. And so that's what I've grown up around. And so that's what I know. And
that was going to be my next question was your mom and dad both were both of your parents like super open arms like that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Both of them.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Modeled that behavior of just open door, open arms.
Yep. I tell everybody my mom and dad's house was the mission growing up. Your family, you can stay. You're a friend, you can stay.
Your career at Mirror, you started almost 8 years ago?
Almost nine.
Oh, almost nine. Sheesh. Almost 9 years ago. What did you think when you first started?
I was scared. I was nervous. I didn't know. Once I did come over, I didn't know if it was something that I was going to stay in. I started PRN. And so at first I was just pretty much a driver, but not even a month in, I loved it. I enjoyed it. I was like, hey, they're just like me, mm-hmm. you know, and I love it. I enjoy what I do. I've enjoyed it every day. I don't even look at, I don't get up like I got to go to work today. You know, I enjoy what I do. So I don't call in. I'm here. You know, I love it. And I try to get people in. Like I'm doing scheduling now and I'm like, I don't want to do scheduling because I want to get all these people in and I can.
I know. And that brings me to our most recent interaction with a client or a potential client seeking treatment, suffering in a crisis and suffering. The first thing I thought in my head was, I need to call LaShonda. And you did. You're that connecting point for so many people. And working with you for so many years and knowing you, I could see that be extremely tough to tell someone begging for a bed at the treatment center to tell them, okay, we're looking at February.
It's hard. It's real hard. And then when you hear them crying on the phone, that's hard. When you have to tell them, no, you can't come in because I'm full or you're funding, you know, whatever the situation is. And the answer is still no. And they have this crisis going on, but I still can't get you in. It's a hard situation.
That would be extreme. Do you feel like funding, especially in the past year with like expansion of block grant funding and ARPA, of course, has that gotten better as far as getting more people in?
I could say yes, but since our census are down, that would be my only reason for saying, I don't know. You know?
Good point. Yeah, you guys have had some...
We've had a rough year.
You've rough year.
Well, we've had a few, so...
Especially looking back to Richard, I mean, 2020 pandemic, I mean, just being a treatment, residential treatment center in a pandemic, and then beloved director has cancer, that was...
And pretty much since then, yeah.
You were one of the main points of stability through all of that because it went for years. Why was it important to you to keep things running?
So we have a family. We are a family at Mirror. Steve, that's my backbone. People think it's me, but it's Steve.
And for those of our clinical supervisor.
Clinical supervisor, Steve, yeah. But a lot of people think it's me, but it's not me. It's Steve. If it wasn't for him, I couldn't do what I do. Sheila, she is wonderful. Mm-hmm. Everything I've learned, I've pretty much learned it from her. Sherry. So I say Sherry, Steve, and Sheila today because in the beginning, it was rough, you know, before, well, with Richard being sick, you know, and so having to pick up those pieces and wanting to keep everybody on board, you know, it was hard trying to stay afloat, but we did it. I do it for Richard. Mm-hmm. I love Richard to death. Mm-hmm. And everything I do, I say, is for Richard, because I seen what he did at Mirror and for Mirror. And so that's what I want to keep going.
His legacy, being a part of his legacy. Oh, yes, I love that. Oh, I talked about Richard throughout various podcasts because I loved him so much, and everybody did. To know him was to love him. Mm-hmm. We would ride to Newton together each month for the management meetings, and by the time we get there, my stomach would hurt so bad from laughing. And he was so in love with Sherry, and was just, he loved people. Like, he would do anything for anyone. I was thinking about his retirement party shortly before he passed, about how you couldn't even fit anyone in. I mean, it was so packed. I was also thinking about, you have a very special place with his picture in our admin building, and the day someone knocked it over.
Yeah. I was going to go to jail that day.
I mean, that's probably the worst thing someone could do at Mirror, just so for future reference or anybody.
Yes.
You don't mess with the heart of our program.
Yes.
You know, he's playing the drums in heaven for sure. Mm-hmm. He's busy.
He used to be quiet, but you know, Richard, he always played music and stuff. So now Jack plays music. So it's kind of like a good vibe, and it just brings back Richard a little bit, because Richard, he'll listen to any kind of music. So Jack has it on this station to where it plays all kind of music. So it's kind of got that little feel of Richard in the admin building now.
I love that so much. How do you, with a job that's so heavy, and I was thinking about this, actually, I was thinking about you last night with our interaction. I took so much of that home until I went to sleep at night and woke up that morning thinking about this client. How do you not take it home with you?
I take it home every day.
How are you still okay every day?
I just keep going. I just keep going. But I take work home every day. I think about clients every day. Some clients, it's like if they don't show up for their initial intake time and they call at 5 and it's like, I'm leaving, you know, and then it's like I go home and it's like, what if that client ODs? Mm-hmm. So that's on my mind all night, you know, and so it's just like, it's a lot. Even with clients in the facility, I think about them. I'm not in charge. I don't have to know what's going on. I just like to know what's going on with all the residents in the facility. And it's a lot of us do like to stay in the loop just so we know. And so the clients know that we do care. You're not just a dollar bill when you come here. We care about you. We care about you when you walk through this door. And then we care about you, how your life continues when you leave from here, your family, when you come to me.
And it shows, and it's interesting too, because I've seen you in situations when you need to deal with something that's not fun, and you need to, I'll just say, regulate a bit. But you do it in a way that people still love you. Like, it just is kind of remarkable how
you. And I'll say, like, well, you get mad at this individual for saying that, but I can say it rough. And so sometimes it's the delivery. And I'm a firm believer, because I can take what you say to me, but it's how you say it. Mm-hmm. So clients need to be respected too. So you need to respect a client, or you're going to get what you get, you know, so that's it.
We have an entire training on that, about mutual respect, and with people coming through the doors, and sometimes with the only thing they have is the clothes on their back. When you say something that makes them feel belittled, or you say it in a way that makes them feel any sort of way, it is a lot of times a very explosive situation, because that's all they have. That's all they have at this point in time is themselves and their word and the clothes on their backs. How do you take care of yourself with everything you carry? How do you take care of yourself?
It's just day by day. I have my daughters at home, my son. So I have my kids and I have my guy. So I still take work home, but I still have a life outside of work. Play dominoes with my dad and my brother probably every other day. But I just keep going.
Is that how you relieve stress?
Yeah.
What about, we heard a lot during COVID about like empathy and compassion fatigue because pouring yourself into so many other people. How do you not get burnout?
I think you have to enjoy what you do, and that's what keeps you going. I enjoy what I do, and that's what keeps me going. A lot of us at Mirror enjoy what we do, and that's what keeps us going. And so even like us, and I speak for a lot of us, mm-hmm. we could be sick, but we're still going to come to work as long as our legs are working because the facility still needs to be ran, and we want to run it. So regardless if we're sick, we're still showing up, you know, unless we're on our deathbed, but we're going to make sure that our clients are taken care of. If we don't come to work, who's going to be there? We've been on a skeleton crew for some years, mm-hmm. you know, and that was rough. And so some of us had to keep going. Like, we didn't have a choice to stay at home, you know, or nothing like that. We had to go to work, and we did. We were there, and we're still here.
I think you're right about finding your calling, because I feel like that too. I truly, there's probably been a few days my entire career where I haven't wanted to go to work, and it was because of some specific, you know, catastrophic thing. But otherwise, it's part of your life. It's mm-hmm. part of who you are. It's part of your identity. And that's what makes you, I think, just a treasure for Mirror and for all these people seeking hope and a brighter tomorrow. You're their first face. I'm so grateful for that. I was thinking, we're getting ready to have the Christmas parade tomorrow. And last year, I'm sure you've heard this story, but last year, the Christmas parade in Topeka, going down Kansas Avenue, you know, Sarah Schooler, she organizes all that, puts a lot into it. So anyways, we're going down Kansas Avenue and a woman screams out, "Mirror saved my life." And we all, it was freezing, but everybody was just pumped up. Mm-hmm. And then you hear that a lot when Mirror's brought up. Someone will just say things like that, like saved my life or saved my sibling's life or my parents' life, you know, and that keeps us going.
We love to hear that. We love to hear stories. We have gentlemen who work at great jobs, who give back to Mirror, who have been through the facility. They live in Oxford. They take time out of their schedule to give back to Mirror. And I believe it's because how they were treated while they were at the facility.
Oh, I asked that in so many different podcast episodes where people, I didn't even sometimes know they went through Mirror, but I'll say, what do you think it was about Mirror? And they, you know what they say every time? The people. Mm-hmm. You can hear that they say the people. It's not a place. It's the people that are making it work and making the program successful. I think a lot of that is, like you said, just family and the culture that you guys have built. Mm-hmm. As a woman of color, what are some accessibility needs in our community for treatment as far as making sure everyone has an opportunity to receive treatment?
I don't think it has to do with color. I've heard that before as far as like we don't get a lot of colored people into treatment, but it's not about the treatment. It's about us as individuals wanting the treatment. I felt like I was an alcoholic, mm-hmm. right? But I didn't know I was an alcoholic until I started working at Mirror, as a client's story was my that was my life, right? And so I was an alcoholic because I didn't wake up drinking every day. I went to work, but it was Groundhog Day every day. I got off work, I went to the liquor store, I drank, went to sleep, did the same thing every day until I started working at Mirror. So I don't need help. I'm of color. I don't need help with my mm-hmm. drinking. As far as the color, mm-hmm. I just don't think that we feel like we need somebody to help us with our treat.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. And that's really striking to me, too, when you said you didn't identify or see yourself as having an issue or an alcoholic until you worked for a treatment center.
Yes, because it wasn't a problem. But the lady's story, everything she said, that's how I live. And so I'm like, well, maybe I was an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. I respect and appreciate Mirror because I'm not in recovery, but I can't drink every day. I can't come to work smelling like alcohol. So I appreciate Mirror is my recovery. Mm-hmm. It lets me not be able to drink mm-hmm. every day. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's like, so as far as the color, I don't think it's a color. I had a counselor one time ask me a question as far as, why don't you get a lot of African-American referrals? And so I say, I don't make the referrals. I receive the referrals, but individuals of color have to go get the assessment done. Caucasian, Mexican, it's up to you to go get the assessment done. I'm not picking and choosing if you're Caucasian, Mexican, or African-American, if you're going to be able to come into the facility. I just don't think we see that we have a problem unless somebody makes us.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Part of that, too, could be maybe more intentional outreach. You know, to where you're providing education on to, and a lot of that, I think, when I was working on the ARPA grant, we were thinking about intentional outreach. And so, for instance, that's having materials translated to Spanish and then also having the ability to have translation services and things like that, like intentional outreach, because otherwise, how are individuals who can't read our brochures going to seek treatment unless referred by someone else who's bilingual? So that's kind of what I appreciate is your perspective. Thank you for sharing your perspective.
I don't see a lot of colored African-American referrals. Mm-hmm. So that's where it starts. Okay. We need to ask for the help. I have a lot of alcohol runs in my family. So I have alcoholics in my family. Love them to death. Some of them will take the bottle to the grave with them. I'll be right there with them. But do they think they need help? Absolutely not. Do I push it on them? Absolutely not. You know, that's all they know.
Because you've got to want it. It's got to be within you. And that's something I have seen. I know you have seen in both of our careers is you can't want it more than someone else. They have to be the driving force. They are the captain of their ship and of their future.
And people will call, like, if they know that somebody's, Melissa says she's going to get an assessment done. Mm-hmm. So then they'll call me. LaShonda, did Melissa get her assessment done? Did Melissa call you? And did you call? And I'll say, no, no, no. And they'll say, well, Shonda, call her. And I say, no, I'm not going to call Melissa. Melissa has to call me.
Yeah.
So I know that Melissa wants this. I can't want this for Melissa. Melissa has to be the one to call me, and I'll transfer Melissa to the assessment center.
Oh, and you're spot on. I think about all of the mothers and parents over the years and the calls you field as well, where you're like, I can only imagine what you're going through, but they have to be the ones. The person has to decide that this is what they want.
I had a lady call me one day for a referral, and she said that the guy was a professor. So she just wanted to make sure that he was going to go into a room with somebody like him. And with me being me, it took everything in me not to tell her he will be with somebody like him. A lot of people like him, you know, not a professor, but an addict, just like him, you know, because BNC is a professor doesn't make him nothing better than anybody else. Sure. That's in that, you know, and so that's hard for me.
Yeah.
You know, because it's like, that's judgmental. They're all the same.
Yeah. I had, when I was a director of the RRC, I would sometimes get people who would be upset with my roommate. Oh, you know, in the prison, this is how it was. I'm like, basically, you're asking for segregation. And so when they'd say, who's my roommate? I would say, you have a human being roommate. That's your roommate. Mm-hmm. And anything else, we're not having this conversation. This will not be a conversation we have. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yes. But the professor thing too, it's like, you will have a person and a roommate who is in the same situation as you are. Uh-huh. Clients calling back in, that's probably one of my favorites, stopping back. And I love when people stop back in.
I love it when they call with outpatient being right there. I love to see them coming back. When outpatient first moved over there, I had seen clients that I hadn't seen for years. So just seeing them, I love that. I love when they call me. I got clients from 6-7 years. I have a client who calls me periodically, whether he's sleeping in a ditch or he's up in the Hilton. But he'll call me and let me know how he's doing. And that's why I do what I do. Mm-hmm. For those phone calls.
Do you have like a limitless heart for this population? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what it, in my experience with you, it just, you really are always going the extra mile for other people.
I love it.
I like hearing the history as to like what led you here and more about you. That's been really, really incredible. When you went back to school to get your GED, why was that something you wanted to do?
I think it was for my kids more than it was for me. And I failed my GED the first time. Okay. So I said, well, I'll do it again. But if I fail it this time, I'm done. I don't care. And that was my mentality. But I passed. And so I was just proud of myself. And I just wanted for my kids. I wish I would have graduated, but I was too busy running the streets.
When did you leave school?
Probably the middle of 10th grade.
Okay.
And not for no reason. My mom and dad dropped me off at school, and then I'd leave out the other side and be back before they can pick me up, you know. So it wasn't like my mom and dad didn't care. It was just like I didn't care. But I did it for my kids. My son, he graduated, and my daughters will too, you know. So I just wanted to have it for them more than me.
I know. I've ran into you. I don't know if it was at your youngest who I ran at the store. Yeah, very, very sweet. What is your favorite thing about being a mother?
I love my kids. I love being a mom. Just having my kids around me. My kids are my friends, my best friends. My son is my best friend, but they're my friends. And I know I have them when I don't have anybody. And I love being there for them.
Without getting into any of the details, are you okay if we briefly talk about your son? So, and again, if it's something that you want to go off track, but talked about what the best part of being, your favorite part about being a mother. What's the hardest part about being a mother?
The hardest part, I would say my son was shot this year in May. So that was the hardest part, is seeing him laying on the table with a breathing tube in him. And he's 20. So in the 20 years of being a mother, that was my hardest part, because I felt helpless. And he's a mama's boy, not by choice, because he don't have a choice. Mm-hmm. He's always been a mama's boy. That was my hardest, just not being able to help him. Hearing the nurse, he was sedated and having to, and the nurses yelling at him. But me being there to being able to calm him and bring him aware, that it made me feel good. But just seeing him on that table, on that bed, helpless, to this day, it affects me. I haven't got over that. I probably never will. I love my son. And to hear my son tell me some stuff about it. So, and then when he tells me that he was just trying to get out of there because he didn't want to die there, I hear that a lot in my head. I vision it. So I deal with that. I'm not going to say I deal with it. I haven't dealt with it. So I carry that. I had a lot of thoughts going. I wanted to go kill people, really. I didn't care about going to prison. In my mind, I've paid my dues. I paid for my room in prison. I know I had my daughters. I felt like my daughters would be okay with their dad. I was ready to go to prison.
What stopped you?
My daughters. That was it. Even my son still being alive, wasn't enough to stop me. Somebody had hurt my son, and I wanted to hurt them. But in the end, my daughters is what stopped me.
I'm so glad he's okay. And I remember we all, it was devastating. And so many people love you, and to watch you be in agony, agony. I'm so glad he's okay.
Thank you.
And just moving forward.
My brother is a big part. A lot of my family, we are close knit. My nieces and nephew, I'm the favorite auntie because I'm the cool auntie. But we're all close. My nieces and nephews, my sons and my daughters, they're more like brothers and sisters than they are cousins. That's how we raise our kids. So like my brother and my son, they're more like dad and son. So my brother, he helped me a lot through it. My guy helped me so much through it.
Violence has greatly impacted your family. I mean, this is just I probably know a small degree to what extent. How do you continue to move forward after having such traumatic events rock your family?
I think with me, I hold a lot in because I try to be strong for everybody else. So one day I probably will have a breaking point, and I don't know when that is, but I try to stay strong for everybody else around me. But we all have a breaking point. I haven't reached mine yet.
I hope you don't.
Like, I hope I don't. You know, it's only so much people can take.
What about faith? Like, how do you feel about faith? And it's okay if you don't.
I believe in God, and God has gotten me to where I am today. I don't go to church. I'm not a hypocrite. You know, I'm not going to go to church and that's, I love God and God loves me.
One of the things I felt a good chunk of my adulthood, I would think if I serve God through the way I'm living my life, like that's how I think you serve God, is by every single day of how you live your life and how you treat others. Which I say you treat others very, very well.
Well, you don't hear me every day.
Well, one of my favorite things is your frame at work. What does it say?
It says your customer service voice went to Harvard, but my something about me being ghetto. But it is completely 1000% me. But I am what you give me is what I give you. Respect goes a long way, and that's how I feel. People used to say, like, we need to treat the clients like addicts. I don't know what that is. I treat you like an individual. I treat you how I want to be treated. And I think that's why a lot of the so I was a tech for 5 years, and then I moved over to the admin. I didn't know if I wanted to be in the admin because I didn't know if I could still interact with the clients, but I do. I let the clients know I'm here 8 to 5. If you need me, I'm here. Mm-hmm. I go to the building. The RRC clients, I don't really interact with them, but if I'm outside smoking and they're in passing, I'll speak to them. I could brighten their day. I could make them mad. I don't know, you know, but I'm going to speak to them because I don't know if I'm going to brighten your day or not, you know, but a lot of them know me and it's just in passing. Like I don't deal with them on a daily basis, but it's just in passing with them. And it's just, how's your day? Or it could be the Chiefs and the Raiders, you know, something like that. But with the RRC, I think I start mine with Chiefs and Raiders. And that's just to get a feel on them, you know, like if the communication, you know, but RRC, if you need anything from me, I'm here to help you too.
Yeah, I love that. And it's a starting point for acknowledging this person. I mean, everyone, that's what they want. They want to be seen, acknowledged, heard. What are your dreams for the community related to treatment?
I don't think there is enough treatment out here for individuals. Topeka has 2 treatment facilities. I don't think there's enough funding for individuals. A lot of our clients can't get in because of their funding. I hate telling clients that on the phone. You can't get in because you don't have any money. I hate being the one to say that. But I think funding is an issue and the lack of other treatment facilities.
I think that's a really big part of what people don't realize is that almost exclusively our clients do not have health insurance. I mean, we're working with people who fall well below poverty level. And then that's one of the reasons why we received ARPA funding, is because we were able to demonstrate that there's such a great need in our community. You've emulated or carried on a lot of Richard's legacy. What do you want to be known for?
I just want to continue his legacy. I want to keep doing what I'm doing.
And what do you think that is?
Helping people.
Helping people no matter what.
No matter what.
No matter what. I like that. What does hope mean to you?
Hope means that there's light at the end of the tunnel.
Yes, I agree. I think about that in so many ways. There's a tomorrow. There's this brighter future ahead. I was going to tell you too, the other, when I was stressing out about the client, I was thinking, I really, on the RRC side, I don't know where someone is. I just have someone check their GPS.
Yeah.
And if they walk away, they're going to face new charges. So they usually don't. Typically, they don't. What's hard on the treatment side is that at any time, someone can decide, this isn't my time. They can walk away at any time. And so that was probably one of the things that hit me, like, gosh, you guys have it so hard because you pour so much into someone and they can walk away at any time.
Anytime. And sometimes we take it personal because we love what we do. So like trying to get people in, or, you know, bending over backwards to get people in for such and such reasons or whatnot. And then it's like, do I want it more than you do?
Yeah.
You know, I have people call all the time, and then, you know, in my mind, it's like, you didn't even, you only stayed 2 days last yeah. time. You only stayed 3 days the time before, you know, it's like, so in my mind, it's like, do I really want to try to put you in front of these other people who may stay and complete, you know? So it's hard.
That's tough. Mm-hmm. And then too, I was thinking, this was just last night, I left work just feeling kind of defeated. And I, in my head, well, I said it out loud too, but I was just like, I wish I didn't care so much. Like, I wish I could turn that off, like just not care so much.
It's hard.
And someone said to me something that is, goes back to instilling hope, where it was actually Jason. He emailed me, or it was on the phone, and he just said, maybe they'll come back. And I was like, so then I had like a 50-50, and I was like, maybe he's right. Maybe they'll come back. And then boom, first thing I saw this morning. So I applaud you guys, because that's, you deal with that every single day. And this was a little, you know, 6-day, 7-day thing for me. So I applaud what you all do.
It's hard sometimes, you know, and then we do have clients leave, and then we don't want it to be like, well, I'm going to leave on Friday because I know I can come back on Monday. But then we don't want to set that example for everybody else that's sure. in the facility. Well, I can go out and do what I want to do all weekend because they'll let me come back on Monday. True. So it's hard. And we put that on Steve. A lot. So it's probably hard for Steve. He handles it, but yeah, it's hard, but we manage.
Well, I'm so glad we all have a treasure in our community, and that is you. And so don't ever go anywhere. Take some time off before you have, hopefully never have your breakdown or breaking point.
Don't, I got my days, but I'm not to where I want it. I'm not there. Okay. I love what I do.
And it shows in the work. That's hard to call it work, because you make it a part of your family and your life. So thank you so much for everything you do. This has been incredible learning more about you, and you're my family too. And I love you. So thank you so much. Thank you so much for being here today. This is Melissa and LaShonda with Reentry Reframed, a Mirror Inc. sponsored podcast.
I want to give a shout out.
Oh, okay. I was about to hit your.
I want to give a shout out to Sheila E., Sherry, Steve, Adam. I would like to give a shout out to everybody in Oxford, Nick, Sarah Barr, everybody at Outpatient, everybody at RRC, and anybody that I missed.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you guys are one. We're all one big happy family, but you guys have you guys are very tight knit mm-hmm. on the treatment at Topeka Res for sure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.